Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar.
Has there ever been a cave rescue quite like this one? The Thai military allied with an international team of volunteers searching until the lost boys were found and daringly rescued in remote mountains in northern Thailand.
Earlier this month, the world's attention was focused on that cave in Thailand, where a dozen boys from a soccer team and their coach were trapped for weeks and finally rescued. It brought attention to exploring caves and the people who do it for sport or as a hobby. Caving, or spelunking it's called, and it's very popular here in Pennsylvania, that is home to more than 1,000 caves. To talk about caving, spelunking today, our guest, Patrick Minnick, caver with Franklin County Grottos. Mr. Minnick, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Also joining us today is Kim Schwartz, General Manager of Indian Echo Caverns in Hummelstown. Ms. Schwartz, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. There was so much attention focused on Thailand and the boys' soccer team that was trapped for weeks and just a miraculous rescue that occurred. Just wanted to get your thoughts throughout this ordeal as it was getting worldwide coverage. What were you thinking? What were you looking for? What were you listening for as this was all occurring? Pat Minnick, what about you?
Well, I'm also a sub-regional coordinator for the Eastern Region National Cave Rescue Commission, and I was receiving some emails about the ongoing rescue. And obviously, I was in great fear of a negative outcome. And I'm very pleased that we have a positive outcome, that the people were saved. And unfortunately, the one Thailand Navy SEAL lost his life, in the dive. So I realize cave diving is implicitly dangerous, has a lot more difficulties than just above air caving. So very fearful, but the outcome is mostly positive, and I'm glad of the outcome.
So what were you looking for in particular that would signal danger or signal something that was very significant that maybe the rest of us didn't know, someone who has the experience that you do, that you were looking for?
In the United States, there are caving accidents every year, and the National Speleological Society, of which I'm a member, publishes American Caving Accidents, which documents where those accidents occurred, what type of, some are just incidents, people lost, a sprained ankle, and then occasionally are there fatalities. They break that down between fatalities in fatalities in a dry cave and fatalities cave diving. And in the United States, there are probably as many cave diving fatalities, United States and in Mexico, South America, as there are dry caving accidents. The diving aspect of course, it's a very active cave. The water was coming up. The water was flowing. Those are dangers that are beyond what one might normally experience when they go in a cave.
Mm-hmm. So, Kim Schwartz, what about you? What were you thinking about?
Well, first of all, I want to reiterate that probably most of the accidents that occur are in wild caverns and not in what we would call a show cavern. But anybody,
and I want to talk to you about that, too.
And anybody who has never been in a cave can't quite understand the geology of the cave and the labyrinth forms, like it's a maze in there. So the fact that the boys were originally found in the first place was quite amazing. That they were able to be brought out was even more amazing. But, you look at the rising water with the water coming in and how far back they could possibly be, and then trying to get them out, the silt in the water with the divers, it was really questionable whether they could get all of the boys out, and they did an amazing job.
Mm-hmm. These boys weren't experienced cavers. It would seem to say, do not go into a cave if you don't know what to expect, if you don't know what's in there, or if you don't have experience. Or would that be an accurate statement?
Well, I think anybody who wants to go into a wild cave should have some direction from probably their local National Speleological group. There's many of them around Pennsylvania. Pat here is a member of the Franklin County. We also have a York Grotto. That's what they call themselves. And they would probably be more than happy to take people in and show them the right way to Spelunker Cave.
Mm-hmm. But getting back to my original statement, probably not a good idea to go in if you've never done it or you have very little experience.
I would agree with that, yes.
Okay. What about you, Pat? What do you think about
well,
that?
Well, I would first off lay out a number of rules for a group or individuals that want to go in cave. You need a helmet. You need three sources of light. You need a group of at least four. You need to establish a turnaround time so that if you're gone, that somebody comes looking for you. And certainly you need to know the cave. So if a cave is subject to flooding, if a cave has certain factors in it that would be dangerous, you need to know that ahead of time.
Mm-hmm. And you've made a distinction here between caving and cave diving. The danger arose with these young boys when the water level rose. I don't know if there was any water in that cave in Thailand to begin with, but it rained and the water rose, and they couldn't get back to the beginning of the cave. Does that happen often? I mean, are there a lot of caves like here in Pennsylvania that the same kind of thing could happen, that you go into the cave and it rains like what we've had over this past weekend and water levels rise?
Well, of course, I think that all caves, if they're along a creek, or in that instance with the monsoon season,
right,
they can have
monsoon
rising.
Is much different than, although we probably experienced that this weekend.
Yeah, we've had a lot of rain here the past couple of days. But I think that if a cave is, there are caves that are high and away from water, well, the chance of them having any flooding issues is probably next to nothing. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree. Caves are formed both above the water table and below the water table, and many caves were formed years ago are now above the existing water table. There are other caves that are right at the water table. A typical cave in Pennsylvania is 52 to 55 degrees, 100% humidity, generally muddy. And, you know, there are caves in Pennsylvania, not many, but there are caves in Pennsylvania that have streams that could rise to the point where, you know, they would threaten the person that came in.
You know, maybe it's a good time to define or describe what a cave is. I mean, if we go by what we've seen traditionally in stories, television, movies, that there's this big wide opening and people are able to walk right in and, okay, they start a fire and everybody is safe unless there are wild animals in there. But that's not exactly what a cave is. How's a cave defined?
One of the best definitions I know of was in an article written by Will White, retired professor at Penn State, explaining that a cave is a natural opening in a rock, you know, and you have to not necessarily away from darkness, because there are caves that are daylight the whole way to the bottom. But he wrote a pretty good definition of it, and it's a scientific definition of what the caves. And I would say most of the caves in Pennsylvania are formed in limestone as a result of solutional processes, organic acids percolating down through the soil, dissolving the limestone. But there are other caves that are also formed by fractures in the rock. These would be tectonic caves. Worldwide, there are ice caves. There are lava tubes. All fit the definition of being a cave.
But I think what we think of as a cavern or a cave is something that you see an entrance and you walk in. Not all caves have a giant entrance. I mean, some are very hidden, and it might be a sinkhole in your backyard.
Could be a cave.
Could be a cave.
Now, why would that be a cave? Would a sinkhole
be
a cave?
Most of the time, you know, a cavern, what we think of as a cavern that you would go in, or a cave that you would go in, are usually formed by streams at some point. They carve out the rock. As he said, it's a solution process where the limestone, the calcium carbonate, is dissolved. It washes out. The streams and the water flow will make a pathway out back to whatever body of water is closest. So usually, a sinkhole will have an opening underneath of it. That's the technical definition. You know, mm-hmm. you have this opening, and it might be a small opening at first, but underneath, if it's larger, you can often tell the size of the room by the diameter of the hole on the outside. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it might be a little tiny, depending, mm-hmm. a little tiny cave, but it would probably fit the definition of the cave.
Okay, so let me talk about Indian Echo Caverns and caverns like Indian Echo Caverns. This is a cavern, a cave, under the definition, but it is a place that is safe. It is a place where there are many visitors that come to see it. The difference between, like, say, an Indian Echo Caverns and a cave that someone can walk into, a wild cave, as you described it?
Well, of course, it was interesting. Our cave is one of the first known caves in the colonies. And at that time, people would go into the entrance as far as they could see or with their lights. In 1929, it was commercialized, as so they say, and they went in and they put in over 1,000 lights, leveled the pathways, put gravel down, so it was a safe walking experience because so many people wanted to be able to experience what a cave was like. So they, you know, they made it very safe and very well lit so that people could enjoy the natural beauty.
Mm-hmm. Is the cave inspected?
We are inspected twice a year by the Bureau of Deep Mine Safety.
Mm-hmm. Has it changed at all over the years? I mean, are there places in the caverns that you've had to close for visitors because there have been changes?
Actually, no. The only changes we have in our cavern, technically, that we've ever been able to document is actual growth, because we have a live cavern. So the water is still coming through the ceiling of our cavern. We're still getting formations growing. So that's why we always ask visitors, like, not to touch the walls because of the oil on their fingers. They'll actually inhibit that growth. As we know, oil and water doesn't mix. So our cave is still forming and growing.
We'll talk more, a lot more about this in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. With the world's attention focused on the cave in Thailand over the past month or so, we decided to talk about caving or spelunking. And we'll talk about the difference, if there is a difference, between those two terminologies coming up. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Our guest today, Kim Schwartz, General Manager of Indian Echo Caverns in Hummelstown, and Patrick Minnick, caver with Franklin County Grottos. There are other grotto clubs in the area as well. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, so one thing I read during the whole situation in Thailand was there was someone who said, I am a caver, I am not a spelunker. So what is the difference? This guy seemed to take offense that those who explored caves were referred to as spelunkers.
We cavers generally refer to ourselves as cavers and not spelunkers. When somebody says spelunker, that's kind of a clue that they're new to the game and not knowledgeable about the nomenclature. So we refer to ourselves as cavers. Cave exploration, you know, is what we do.
All right. So how did you get involved in this?
1971, I was a freshman of college, junior out of college, Huntington, Pennsylvania, and some friends of mine decided they were going to a little cave just south of Huntington, and we went there, and we were ill-equipped with just flashlights, no backup lights, no helmets.
And of course, all the things you told us not to do, you did.
That's correct. but at that point, became aware that there was a network of other cavers out there, that we became aware of the National Speleological Society and techniques, and we formed a club. It wasn't a grotto of the NSS at the time. We formed a club. We acquired some equipment, acquired lights, carbide lights at the time, helmets. And by the time I left, I had some vertical gear and was doing some rope work. So that's how I got started. When I got away from school, you know, all my friends kind of scattered to the four corners. And then I got a phone call one day, hey, let's go to West Virginia. Let's go caving. And I've been, you know, in a few years after I got a paying job, I joined the NSS and have been at it ever since.
NSS?
National Spelological Society.
I just wanted to clarify that.
So what Pat didn't say is the fact that once you go in a cave like that, it's hard not to want to go back in.
Oh, really? Yeah. Why? Why?
The majesty of nature. You can't experience how a cave, the natural beauty of a cavern, if you've never been in one. And people that come in a cave or go in a cave for the first time, especially if it has any beautiful formations or just the whole exploration aspect of being able to see something that maybe nobody's seen before or experience something that is, you know, that many years old, people are will stand there with their mouths open and just be mystified by it. And it makes you want to see more.
See, I have to admit that the only caves I have been in are yours and others that are commercially available for people to walk in. I've never gone into a wild cave. So when you do go into a wild cave, what do you see?
Well, you're providing your own light. If you're going, you know, you see formations. In Pennsylvania, you're going to see mud and you're going to do some crawling. If you go to Tennessee, Alabama, and Georgia, you might be going into deep vertical pits. Some of the best vertical pits in the United States are in Tennessee, Alabama, and Georgia. So you would need to know rope.
What's a vertical pit?
That is a cave that is, you know, you rappel into, and you need to have climbing gear to come out.
Okay.
You need to have the skills to do rope work before you go in. Learning in the cave is a tremendously bad thing.
Not on the job training.
No,
it's kind of like rock climbing inside.
Without the things to climb on.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Fantastic pit, Allison's Cave, Pigeon Mountain, Georgia. From the low rig points, 508 feet from the rig point to the floor.
Wow.
There's a cave in Mexico, El Sotno de la Golondrinas, if I get the name correctly, that's a 1,300-foot rappel. And that's the one you may have seen on TV years ago people base jumping into. But given the fact that you go to the bottom, you know, most mountaineers start at the bottom and work up. Cavers start at the top, and we have to go back up. So you need to have the skills to be on rope to climb back out of there.
Yeah, you've got to go down and up in a cave.
Yeah,
see, what I heard many people saying when the boys were first, well, when they went missing, even before they were discovered, so I heard a lot of people say, I would never do that. I would not go into a cave. And most of the time you would hear is, I just couldn't take that small space. That they were claustrophobic. And it would seem that that's not a hobby you would have if tight spaces or small spaces, if that's something that that gets to you, put it that way.
Well, there are wild areas of Mammoth Cave in Kentucky, a famous national park that you could walk for a considerable distance in the wild area that are big passage, big what we call borehole passage. It go you know. Of course, you have to climb up and down over the rocks and everything. There's no paved pathway, no lights. In a way, a caver is just another form of outdoor recreation. You know, people who are cavers, one of the questions was, who's a caver? Well, it's a form of outdoor recreation, like hiking, backpacking, hunting, whitewater rafting or whatever, and certain people, you know, get involved with caving. So many of our members are into other forms of outdoor recreation also. If you wanted to be a mountaineer and climb Mount Rainier, you've got to go to the Cascades. You've got to go to the West Coast. But if you want to go caving, you can go a few hours in West Virginia and you're there.
But there are caves where there are tight spaces, right?
Absolutely.
Many caves.
Even in Indian Echo Caverns, there are some places where you kind of have to lift your feet and climb through, correct?
You have to duck, and we have maybe one narrow passage. Now, I think as far as Pennsylvania caves, we have some larger open areas. I think our cave is very open, and most people that will express some concern are mostly okay. We have the occasional person that decides they're claustrophobic and they would like to come back up, which is fine. We respect everybody. At least they give it a try. But our cave is pretty open. A lot of caves are pretty open. But there's some that you really have to duck low or crawl through. I mean, there's areas in our cave that people can't get to because it's just too tight for a group of tourists to be able to get in.
Have you been to places in the cave that is not open to the public?
Of course.
And like what's it look? I mean, there are areas designated, as you said, designated for the visitors to walk through. And I don't know how big it is compared to those areas. I mean, if you had to make a comparison, is it twice as big, three times?
No, most of our cave is open to the public. We do and have had some ongoing studies to see whether our cavern goes further, and they do believe it is. We haven't done any exploration back into those areas yet, but there's certainly places in our cave that the people can't go that you can get in, and you can tell when other people have been in there before because there's some graffiti, names and things carved in the rocks, painted on or written on. And then there's places where, you know, that are very pristine and are beautiful because they've not had any damage by people. So I think with the people that are cavers that go in the wild caves, if they get into certain ones that aren't muddy, you're going to see some really, really amazing things.
You say graffiti, Native American graffiti or?
No, interestingly enough, the Native Americans probably didn't go past our entrance. They usually, because of their beliefs, wouldn't go in the dark. We tended to really, during the Victorian era, have a lot of people go in with torches, break off formations as far as for an oddity to take home as a souvenir. Of course, we also had William Wilson that lived in the cave.
I was going to mention William Wilson, yeah, the guy who lived there for how long?
19 years.
19 years in the cave.
Yes.
He had to come out, didn't he?
Well, eventually he did, yes. He did come out, and he worked at a grist mill. But he spent most of his winters in the cave sleeping on a ledge, so he was safe.
All right, well, that brings up a point, and I'm curious about wildlife in caves. I mean, I know there are bats in a lot of caves, but and we know that bears hibernate in caves, and I've actually seen video of the Pennsylvania Game Commission reaching into a cave and pulling out a bear. What about wildlife? You ever run into wildlife?
I have. A few years ago, I was in a tight cave in Franklin County and went around a corner in the fall and ran into a sleeping raccoon, and he was only like a foot and a half away. But as a general rule, most of the life in the cave is specific to the cave. Cave crickets, bats, that type of thing.
Salamanders.
Yeah, salamanders. People ask about snakes. I've seen a couple of snakes in a cave, but not deep in a cave. I mean, if for example, at Tituna Cave in Blair County, which is an NSS cave preserve, there's a stream going through it. Well, if a water snake's in the stream, he could go down the stream and be in the cave. So you might find a snake in a cave, but generally, you get very far away from the entrance, and you're back to the basic cave life, which is cave crickets, bats, amphipods.
What's a cave cricket?
Actually, a little thing like a little white insect, sort of like a grasshopper, that's peculiar to caves.
I don't know if you get blind cave fish in a lake.
Blind cave fish. Mm-hmm. What are blind cave fish?
Well, it's a fish, but because of the darkness, they've lost their ability to see. So they just, through evolution, have managed to live in a pool of water with that certain acidity that the water in the cave may have, like your hard well water. But they've lost their sight.
We have an email here from Sarah Ask, and you had mentioned, Kim, about sinkholes. Wants to know, how are sinkholes and caves related?
I think I can answer that fairly well. Some sinkholes actually lead on to other caves. Some sinkholes are also formed in technical term pinnacle and clutter karst, which is a mixture of rock and soil and everything, where sinkholes occur during rising and falling water tables. So you might have a quarry where the quarry is dewatering the area, and you have the zone of influence where the waters, and you'll have a sinkhole appear that's only in earth. So if this happens in a roadway someplace, you know, the highway department's going to have to excavate it down to stone and backfill it and everything. And there have been some, you know, very serious roadway collapses and things. I think Palmyra is
subject. Yeah, and I was going to ask about that. That brings up a question. If there is an area that has a lot of sinkholes, is prone to sinkholes, like Palmyra, for example, does that mean there are caves around there as well?
Depends on the limestone. Limestone is variable. For example, I used to work in Frederick, Maryland. Frederick, Maryland has the Grove Limestone, which is there's a huge quarry down there along 70 that's been there for years. Roadway material, but it's not a good cave maker. So, you know, limestone's variable in whether it'll make a big cave. To make a big cave like Mammoth, you need thickly bedded limestone, and you need a drainage area. So, you know, drainage area runoff in time, you know. So so some of the sinkhole areas will have small caves but won't necessarily be, you know, there won't necessarily be great caves there. Other areas, Greenbrier County, West Virginia, for example, you drive down the road, you look off into farmland, and there's a huge sinkhole there. Greenbrier County is home to some of the best caves in the East Coast, Greenbrier County, West Virginia. So, but the presence of a sinkhole, as we have in Florida, there are collapses in Florida, doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be, you know, explorable caves there.
From what I understand, history is a big part of the hobby, that a lot of people are interested in the history of how caves formed, how long they've been around. Kim, with Indian Echo Caverns, how long has that cave been around?
Well, the cave itself has probably been forming, what would you say, Pat, over a million years?
At least, yeah, that's a good answer.
It's always hard, and our formations grow at different rates. So, you know, we'll have some bigger formations that are much slower growing, and then we'll have a flowstone, which you could practically see grow. If you've been in, I don't know when you were in last, Scott, but if you would come into our cave now, there'll be changes. Just in a few years, you can actually watch the cave grow.
It has been a few years, so maybe I have to do that again. But that history, Pat, when we talk about cavers exploring for history, what kind of history are you looking for?
Well, when we talk about history, you know, there have been caves that have been known since colonial times. Indian Echo Caverns, Dragon Cave, Berks County, known in colonial times. People actually possibly lost there in colonial times. And other caves weren't known, but in the 1930s, 20s and 30s, a gentleman named Ralph Stone, who was a Pennsylvania State geologist, started, you know, enumerating these things, mapping, going county by county and naming caves, which culminated in his book, Pennsylvania Caves in 1953, which, you know, was a landmark book. In the interim, and since then, I'm going to name two people that are instrumental in cave history in the state of Pennsylvania. One is Dean Snyder in Snecksville. The other is Jack Spies in Altoona. And those gentlemen have, you know, written extensively on historical factors of various caves. There was a cave here. We found who went in, what happened. And they have written extensively, you know, history of the caves.
Mm-hmm. So caves today in Pennsylvania, I imagine that most have been discovered, and by word of mouth, I don't know, maybe it's more than word of mouth, we find out where these caves are that can be explored. First of all, is that accurate? And secondly, if someone listening to this who has never done it before, maybe would like to, where do they find a cave?
Well, first off, I would again refer them to their local grotto, the National Speleological Society. Within the local grotto, we have regions. We're part of the Mid-Appalachian region, and which includes Pennsylvania, Maryland, Delaware, and New Jersey. The organized caving group has publications of maps and descriptions. We don't necessarily hand that out to everybody. And the reason being that caves in the eastern United States are on, for the most part, private property. You go to the western United States, you're dealing with federal land managers. It's on public forest land or whatever. There are a few caves in Pennsylvania actually on Game Commission property, but most caves are on private property. So we work very hard to maintain our landowner relations with the property owners. For example, there are caves that are on property owned by Amish folks. We certainly don't plan a trip there on Sunday, you see. So, if you abuse your landowners, you're going to find when you go back the next time, you won't be welcome. So we go a long ways to cultivate our landowners, and I would recommend anybody who has not done any caving, go to a grotto, get on a beginner trip. There are beginner trips. There are a number of caves that are, beginner trips go to, outing trips go to from, various colleges, Boy Scout troops. The NSS has a good guide on Boy Scouts where what Boy Scouts need to do with outing with a caving trip. And there are maps. And you ask about exploration. When we go to a known cave with a map and follow the map to the end of the cave, we're not exploring. We're just on a recreational caving trip. But I have many acquaintances who are actually doing new exploration, finding new cave. They're going on long trips to the end of the known cave and then finding new area of the cave. And that is a true exploration.
We have a question here from John in Harrisburg. Please comment on the fatal disruption of hibernating bats and vectoring white nose syndrome.
Okay, white nose syndrome is caused by a fungus infecting bats. We think now that it came in on a shipping container into an inland port and was first found around the Albany, New York area. Howe Caverns moved into Pennsylvania, killed great numbers of bats because the fungus got on the bats. The bats weren't able to hibernate. They woke up, used up all their food supply, and died. It killed the little brown bats. It killed the tricolored bats. It killed great numbers of the bats. Some of the caves that had high bat counts, when they did new bat counts, they went back, and there was hardly any caves there. Now, the bats somewhat are recuperating, and this white nose syndrome, the fungus, has moved through all New York, Pennsylvania, Virginia, West Virginia, down into Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia. Most of the eastern U.S. is now white nose positive, including out to Texas and Oklahoma.
Did human contact have anything to do with that?
Well, it was a known fungus in Europe. We think now, and this is what the biologists are telling me. I'm not a biologist, but they think now that an infected bats came in on a shipping container into perhaps New York and then intermingled with the bat population, the wild bat population. There was some suspicion that cavers were spreading it because it jumped from cave to cave to cave. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has, if you check their websites, decontamination protocols. If you go to areas where you don't have white nose, you can't bring your gear. And even the Park Service goes through disinfecting your feet. If you go, for example, into Carlsbad Caverns, go on the wild trip, you'll wipe down your shoes with antiseptic. So the caves, the bats have come back somewhat from white nose. Will they ever be back to where they were before? It was so difficult for some of the bat species that it almost pushed them into being endangered species. What was once a plentiful bat species was becoming endangered species. So yes, there is a protocol for decontamination on white nose, and we try to follow that. but we think that most of the contamination was bat to bat.
Uh-huh. And it's really interesting because I think that people think that bats just live in caves, but as far as many bats, they're happier living in your attic over the summer because they're closer to their food supply. And that's why when you see them around lights and the insects and things like that, and they like to actually go in the caves over the winter to hibernate. And that's when the problem with the white nose syndrome occurs, because they can't hibernate. And they, as Pat said, they use up their food supply and they die.
Well, a fascinating conversation. I want to thank both of you for being with us today. Kim Schwartz, General Manager of Indian Echo Caverns in Hummelstown. Patrick Minnick, caver with the Franklin County Grottos. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Mimi Barish Coppersmith recently published her memoir, Eat First, Cry Later, about her experiences as a first-generation Penn State graduate, wife, mother, community leader, and businesswoman. She joins us now to talk about her book. Ms. Coppersmith, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
For our listeners out there who haven't read your book, can you explain its title, Eat First, Cry Later? What does that mean?
Well, that was translated from Yiddish, is an expression my mother always used, but unfortunately I didn't listen to the Yiddish well enough. It's when you're all stirred up, if you have a problem, it's important to take care of yourself first and then do your crying.
So why did you want to write your memoir?
I think everybody's life is a story, and I felt some of the experiences in my life might help particularly other women to conquer problems.
So what experiences? I mean, now we're going to talk about a number of them, and I can't ask you to list all of them now, but what experiences in your life did you think were significant that would have lessons or would show other women, you know, the kind of life that you lived?
The greatest impact was when my, actually I can tell you one great one and one bad one and one great one, and they're related. On July 25th, 1944, my parents received a telegram telling them that their only son was killed in World War II over Germany, or I guess it was over Italy. In any case, I was at the time 11 years old. It is the one event in my life that has the greatest impact on how my life evolved, because it was at that time that I realized as a youngster that I had to do something to bring happiness back to our home. And that was the first loss I experienced, and it had tremendous impact on me. And I dedicated myself at that time, as a little kid, just deciding that I had to help my parents get over this thing. And then, 11 months later, the spirit of good arrived, and my baby brother arrived and was produced by a 53-year-old father and a 45-year-old mother. And that, to me, seemed like a miracle and just put an exclamation point on my thought that out of all bad, there should be some good.
Let's go back to your brother being killed in World War II. 11-year-olds, obviously, when you see that kind of tragedy and the kind of impact it had on your family at the time, a lot of sadness, obviously. You know, there were a lot of 11-year-olds to say, well, I don't want my parents to be unhappy. I want to do something to make them happy. But life evolves and things changed. For an 11-year-old to dedicate her life to making her family happy or to being happy, that's unusual. How did you go about that?
Oh, I worked harder. I studied harder. I helped others. I gave charity. I volunteered. Life is a multiple story of opportunities, really.
Now, you're Jewish. You grew up here in Pennsylvania during a time of a lot of anti-Semitism, concentration camps, World War II, as you know, you've touched on. But what are some of those experiences, and how did they have an impact on your life?
Well, when I it led me to the path of leadership. My high school senior class was the first group to make a trip to Washington as their senior trip. I led that campaign to make it happen. And I found along the way that what you do that isn't your work is far more significant than what you do at your work.
What do you mean by that?
Extracurricular at Penn State, Meals on Wheels, Food Bank, Breast Cancer. There are so many causes that each of us can give of ourselves in the way that we can contribute, either materially or as a volunteer. If I were starting my life all over again, I would choose to be in development. That would be absolutely exciting work to me, because what you do ultimately helps other people.
When you say development, are you talking about, many people associate that with fundraising or that kind of thing. Is that what you're talking about?
That's what I'm talking about, yes.
I get
the greatest joy out of doing that.
Why?
I feel good. I've made a difference. I'm not just walking around the block.
You know, this is a very personal account and very honest as well. We're going to talk about some of the things that are very personal here in a few minutes. There are a lot of people out there that are learning when they read your memoir about your life and a lot of very personal stories. Was it difficult to relate those personal stories?
Yes. My daughter, Carol, my older daughter, who assisted me in finishing, her criticism of the work I had done was that I only told the good stuff. You have to tell people what made you hurt, what happened.
And so you went back and included those things.
Right. We talked. I wrote the anecdotes. Then we talked about them. And then she kept turning the page so I would get deeper into what really happened.
Well, when you talk about personal relationships, you mentioned your daughter, Carol. You've had, it would be described as a difficult relationship with your daughter, but you have said that this actually brought you closer together. Talk about that relationship, if you would, and how it did bring the two of you closer.
Well, we had 14 months of hard work and sharing together, recalling good things, bad things, and all the rest. We had a battle at the end over some of the things that are too hard to discuss. But from the reaction of people who have read the book, that is probably what helped make them enjoy it, because they could identify with some of the suffering we all experience.
Why did you and Carol have a difficult relationship?
Well, because we're a lot alike, I guess. That may be part of it. And there are certain things that occur in life that are game-changing. And we've had a few of those.
Our guest during this portion of the program is Mimi Barish Coppersmith. She's author of her memoir, Eat First, Cry Later. And Mimi Barish Coppersmith, very involved in the Penn State community, Central Pennsylvania. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. You mentioned a couple of times in the book that you're an investigative journalist at heart, very interested in journalism. Your involvement in the magazine that many people here in Pennsylvania are familiar with, Town and Gown, and your Lunch with Mimi segment. Did that love for journalism come into play when you were writing the book? And if so, how?
To tell stories of my life in as much detail as humanly possible, because these are troubled times. For everybody, really. And I wanted the book to make a difference, particularly in the lives of women who undervalue who they are and their services in many cases, and who need the experience of other people to learn, well, almost every day if you can. We all make mistakes, and it's a little harder for women. And I tried to share the things that helped me get over the bumps, the big bumps, in a roller coaster life.
As I mentioned, you've been very involved in the Penn State community, part of initiatives that involve the arts, troubled youth, women's equality, breast cancer, so many things. You were on the Penn State Board of Trustees. Talk about Penn State today. Obviously, the whole Sandusky scandal brought light to Penn State, and not a very good light in many people's eyes. So talk about the university itself and your experiences with the university and helping it to grow.
Well, it was a job I made a shot at, and I won by the hair of my chinny chin chin in 1976, and it's the best, a great part of my journey of living in central Pennsylvania. You'll notice in my book, I avoided the Sandusky scandal deliberately, because every time it's in the news, it's another black and blue mark for Penn State, and I hurt when Penn State hurts. Penn State gave me a quality education, a high-class education, a great daily newspaper, the Daily Collegian, that's struggling today like all daily newspapers. And I try to look at the sunny side of the street during the crises. I'm not in the PR business, because I would be crippled to handle it. However, there is a time in life when we must move on, and I'd rather not talk about Sandusky.
You often observe in the book that as a businesswoman, that many times you were one of just a few women, maybe the only woman, in a room full of men in business situations. Has that changed? What experiences have you had that way?
Well, it has changed. There are many women in leadership. We've just had a woman complete a wonderful job as mayor of the borough of State College, Elizabeth Gorham, and won by a landslide. Women matter at Penn State. We have had more women deans in the last decade than ever. Unfortunately, a couple of them have just retired. Hopefully, there'll be a balance in the replacement. But they are not chosen necessarily because they're women. Women, happily, they are chosen because they're qualified and they're given a chance to compete on a level playing field. I think Penn State has accomplished that. Whether they've accomplished it yet in equal pay for equal work, I don't know. I haven't examined it. But my hat is off to the current president of Penn State, who, in the wake of a horrible fraternity incident, he has taken the challenge of leading a national move to get this problem fixed across the country. This has been going on for decades. It isn't funny. It's tragic. And I'm glad to see that Penn State's president is at the head of the cure.
Well, we only have about 30 seconds left. I want to thank you very much for speaking with us today. In those 30 seconds, what lessons or what do you want your readers of Eat First, Cry Later to take away from the book?
I want them to have the strength, the power, and the faith that they can do it, that they can lead others to improve the landscape for women, not just here, but in the world. Women are going to surprise us, I hope, in the next election. They're going to vote, but they're going to have an opportunity to vote for a lot more capable women, and that's exciting to me.
Mimi Barish Coppersmith, author of Eat First, Cry Later, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.